Sean O?
You're quite brilliant. Yeah, terrific.
Oh, that is... Oh, that's what it is.
The stadium holds its breath.
It's Duff and Quarters.
Brought to you by Tab Touch.
Well, hello everybody. It's Thursday, which means it's time for the second edition this week of the Duff and Quarters podcast. We are brought to you by Tab Touch. We have a slight change of pace today. We've got Braden Quatermain in, not Glenn Quatermain. Braden Quatermain is not the Quatermain that asked for Josh Kennedy to retire at the end of the year, and Braden would like to clear that up after getting a nice little clip from Adam Simpson a couple of weeks ago.
They say that sons can sometimes be made to pay for the sins of their fathers, but sometimes you can pay for them when they're not even your father.
They're just someone who has the same name as you.
But, well, different spelling. But
yes, well, similar.
It wasn't enough to get me off the hook.
No, it wasn't. No. AFL coaches often tell us to check our facts, but... They don't always check their own.
They get plenty wrong, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Braden, we've got a fair bit to talk about today. a bit happening at our two clubs. From Fremantle's perspective, it's probably list management issues starting to kick in as they roll in towards the end of the season. Not that their season is dead just yet. And West Coast, obviously, selection hotting up as they roll into what is going to be a very competitive final series. And we've also got more issues on the Optus Stadium turf, which part of a great story that you ran in the paper today with the AFL Players Association showing interest and possibly a little bit of concern about the turf.
Yeah, that's interesting. This is only in the last few weeks. The Players Association are actually getting players across the competition to fill out an online little form. They wouldn't provide me with the exact questions, but I understand their things like how did you rate the surface, how did you pull up physically, those sort of things. And I think this actually includes the second tier players as well, so you would hope there can be some benefit. There's been some controversies in Victoria with some of the VFL grounds, and obviously our own waffle grounds aren't always in perfect nick, so hopefully there could also be some benefits that that flow down as well, with a bit of scrutiny on some of the surfaces.
Is our ongoing mail on Optus Stadium that it is the hardest surface, do you think, or do you think there's some doubt about that?
That's what everyone says who plays on it, and I think we have to take their word. But the interesting thing I find about this is the AFLPA are saying they're going to collate these responses at the end of the season. They've only started in the last few weeks. I think you'll find our clubs, especially Adam Simpson, say that the big problem with Optus Stadium is the first half of the season. So if this survey's only been done in the second half of the season, Optus Stadium might dodge a bit of a bullet. I think this might be the best thing for them. It might come out not looking too bad. I think if this is going to be done properly, it probably needs to be done for a 12-month cycle. Let's continue it in and include the first half of next year, because I think the major problem our AFL clubs have is how it comes off being a cricket outfield and gets turned into a footy ground. So I think that's probably more of the issue we need to look at. So if it's only a couple of months survey now, this is probably the best nick that Optus gets in late in the season. So,
yeah, it's an interesting one. I know that it was still quite hard when Collingwood played West Coast a few weeks ago. And in fact, Collingwood, while they didn't make a public issue of it privately, they were quite concerned about the way their players pulled up after playing at Optus. I know one thing that Fremantle said to me earlier in the year is they said it's very much a cumulative thing. So if you play at Optus and then you play at a soft ground the next week, that's not so bad. But if you play at Optus, then you go to Marvel, which is renowned as a hard ground as well because they've got the car park underneath it, and then you come back to Optus and there's that week upon week upon week, then after that third week, then you get a bit of fallout on players very sore, players struggling to get out there and train the next week.
I've always thought the Gabba looks most similar visually to Optus Stadium in terms of an outfield and obviously being a cricket ground, but you don't tend to hear a huge amount of complaints.
Except for the centre wicket area.
Perhaps, I'm talking about the actual field itself, though. Seems to look pretty firm, but perhaps in a town where footy's not king, your voice isn't as loud.
Well, I've got no doubt that... I remember Perth when they used to play games at the Wacker, and I've got no doubt that the Wacker, which was renowned as a hard, fast outfield as far as cricket outfields go, that was never as hard as Optus Stadium. And we used to walk on the Wacker all the time because you were allowed to, back in those days, you used to go and see them train and you used to set up camp inside the fence. So I've got no doubt that Optus Stadium is too hard. And at the end of the day, when your anchor tenants are telling you it's too hard, isn't it?
I just wonder if we may ever reach a point where These clubs turn over a lot of money. They invest a huge amount in trying to get every 0.1% of an advantage that they can.
Mm.
If there's enough willingness to do something about this, I just wonder whether there could be some investigation into what would it cost to dig it up. I know we're playing it at 12 months a year, which is probably going to be the problem. If perhaps West Coast, with all of their money, were prepared to even chip in, is it something that could be looked at one day, digging it up and doing some relaying? I guess the time of the year is the issue.
Well, and I think the other thing I would add to that is that at the moment the AFL's total capital input into Optus Stadium is zero. So maybe this can be the contribution that they can make for the sake of the welfare of their players. Dig it up and redo it so it's more user-friendly for AFL players.
If you're going to do it, though, I think you'd want to do it properly, and it's just going to be hard to fit in, isn't it? But maybe the end of a footy season before the Big Bash starts might be a little window. But
yeah, I would have thought, given that the way they can better surface down now, I would have thought it is quite possible to dig a surface up, say, at the end of the right at the end of the football season, and have it ready to play Big Bash. I would have thought that's doable because the centre wicket obviously takes care of itself because that is a different thing altogether. You know, that's concrete which they lay down wicket beds over. So it's just the outfield really, and I would have thought you could have that in good enough nick to play cricket, and certainly in good enough nick to start the next football season.
It certainly does seem better than it was. The thing I found slightly strange yesterday was we've heard the stadium say for 18 months now there's nothing wrong with it, the players are imagining it. And then yesterday, Mike McKenna said, as you see on the back page of the paper today, it's improved a lot in the last few weeks. Well, if there's been nothing wrong with it for 18 months.
Yeah. I just come back to the comment that I think is the most common sense comment to make on all of this. These are your anchor tenants. These are the ones that will use the ground a minimum of 22 times a year. And while West Coast is in the top four, they'll use it 23 or 24 times a year. If they are telling you it's too hard, it's too hard. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones you're supposed to be keeping happiest. So I think anything Optus Stadium, whether it be their management or the curator or the firm that they've engaged to do the turf, if they're saying anything different to that and the clubs are still saying, no, it's too hard, then the stadium and their management are talking rubbish.
And the other interesting point here is if the Clegghammer readings are saying one thing and the players and clubs are saying another, we need to look at these Clegg readings and whether there's a better way we can go about it, because it seems to be there are some grounds where under the Clegg ratings they test harder, but the players say those grounds are fine.
Mm.
So it's just not measuring up with what players are saying.
And that's because there's a difference between doing any sort of penetrometer sort of a reading, and I don't know what the Clegghammer is, and putting a flat foot down on a surface, isn't it? You know, I know from when I've walked on Optus, the notion of slamming your foot down on that surface repeatedly over a 2.5 hour period, that holds no appeal to me. I mean, I know I'm 55 and all my spinal cord's probably compressed half a centimetre over the years, but I think it's way too hard. And let's move on to a Fremantle list management issue. So you went along to Ross Lyon yesterday and talked about, obviously, the two players in question here are Bradley Hill, who has 2 years of a contract to run after this year, and Ed Langdon, who is out of contract at the end of this year. And you were quite intrigued by Ross's response to questions that were asked on these two players.
It was a strange press conference, probably not the first strange Ross Lyon press conference I've been to this season. So I think it's fair enough to talk about these two players as one issue because they're the Dockers' starting wingmen, and clearly if you're going to lose both of them, it's going to put them in a spot of bother. Certainly you're going to need some backup plans. So on one hand, we've got Bradley Hill, who's contracted for another 2 years, and Ross was asked if he'd asked for a trade, and he refused to answer the question and just said he comes into my office for 20 minutes every week and I'm not divulging private conversations. Yet when it came to Ed Langdon, who's out of contract, he said he was optimistic that they'd hold on to him. So it's what does the contract mean? It's a strange one. Look, on Bradley Hill, I think the Dockers need to take a similar position to what they did with Lockie Weller. They need to turn him into a Lockie Weller. Give us our dream deal on our terms, or get stuffed and leave our player alone. I think that's what Fremantle need to do here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is I know that all the Fremantle fans out there, and they'll be looking at Brad Hill's form. And Brad Hill's form, Braden, I reckon, is better than his best and fairest year.
Yeah, I think this is his best year of his career, I think, this year.
So his value, trade value, is never going to be higher than it is this year. I think that's one thing that Fremantle has to consider when they take a position on Bradley Hill. But the other thing is that with the crisis that would come from losing Brad Hill's run off the wing comes opportunity. And you're absolutely right. It's the Lachie Weller opportunity. I mean, whether he's a top 10 draft pick, I think they have to demand that. And I think they should go after a top 5 draft pick. If it's someone like St Kilda, who appears to be the club that they're talking about, and if St Kilda are so desperate to get him, they're going to try and lever him out of a last 2 years of a contract, just say to him, it's your first draft pick, and that's probably going to be a top 5 draft pick.
I would ask for even more. Start a top 10 draft pick plus a running type player. Doesn't have to be of the quality of Bradley Hill, but someone with some wheels.
So maybe a Blake Akers or someone like that.
Try and replace him, yeah. A top 10 and an outside runner.
Yeah.
And give us your best deal.
The interesting one on Langdon. Now, about a couple of weeks ago, we started to hear that Langdon was all but gone, didn't we? Basically, the mail was that Melbourne was the club and that they were all over him and that he'd pretty much decided that he was going to ask for a trade.
And we know what putting it off until the end of the year usually means.
But obviously, what Ross said yesterday was interesting. And also, I know I had a conversation with a couple of Fremantle people a week or so ago, and they seem to be not yet resigned to losing Langdon. So I wonder whether Fremantle still has one last shot at Ed Langdon before he goes.
Well, you probably wouldn't want to lose both. I just don't think there's a lot. There's Brett Bewley with another pre-season, possibly could sort of fill one of those wing roles, take a bit of a jump with some more responsibility. But I'm not sure there's obvious replacements for them. So I just wonder whether the futures are a bit tangled up. If you can get the deal of the century for Bradley Hill and you let him go, does that then free up a little bit more money to throw Ed's way and make sure you don't lose both of them? It's messy with these two storylines sort of running concurrently. I think Fremantle need to figure out, you know, how many of them they need to keep at a minimum, and then one may sort of benefit the other situation.
Well, let's throw another player into that mix, Bradley Hill's brother Stephen. And the feeling a few weeks ago was that Stephen was a good chance to ask for a trade. He's a free, or not even a trade, he's a free agent, so he can just go. My feeling on that one is that that's shifted a little bit as well. And I get the feeling if Fremantle offers Stephen Hill a reasonable deal, they're a reasonable chance to keep Stephen Hill. Now, obviously, getting Stephen out there has been problematic this year because of that quad problem. But if you could keep Stephen Hill and get him out there, then that takes care of one of the wings as well, doesn't it?
Well, he just hasn't played enough footy for 2 years now, has he, to get his value up enough to become a desirable free hit.
And he turns 30 next year.
I'm not sure that Fremantle can offer him more than 1 year, though.
Yeah.
I guess that if someone comes after him with 2 years and a bit more money, then he's got a decision to make. But I would have thought it's one only that the Dockers could be offering Stephen Hill now.
He'd be a massive punt for any club to offer him 2 or 3 years, you would think, given his recent soft tissue injury track record, but certainly an absolute top quality player and an absolute top quality ball user.
And young enough to still have some upside. I mean, one year may turn into three. Hopefully he's healthy next season, plays 15 to 20 games, and then he goes on. Hopefully they do get 3 years out of him, but I think it can only be one up front.
Moving on to West Coast, Braden, there's a logjam at selection for West Coast now with the possible, maybe even likely return of Jamie Cripps to the team.
Yeah, I've been thinking for a few weeks now that Jared Cameron's going to fall out of the team, and he keeps surprising me and keeps staying in. So it's a great effort for him to do what he's done, but I just can't. I can't fit him into a best 22 if everyone's fit. I think Jamie Cripps obviously comes straight back in. It probably becomes an issue of going forward, whether you like that sort of extra sort of hybrid tall in Jake Waterman or whether it's just the straight swap for Cameron. So that'll be the issue.
So if the four players you're looking at are Cripps, Petrocelli, Cameron and Waterman, and three get in and one misses out, who's the one that misses out in your selection? It's Cameron.
I've got Cameron missing out, and then if another one was to come out, it's Waterman. But, yeah, I think Petrocelli's in my team.
Two things I like about Waterman. He kicked a couple of goals last week, obviously, which will help shore up his position in the shorter term. to me, one, he plays well in the structure. He's a very selfless player, I think, Jake Waterman, and whatever Adam Simpson needs him to do and wherever he needs him to be, I think he does that very well. The other thing I think is that if Nick Natanui doesn't get back and if Oscar Allen is to be the backup ruckman, I think that hybrid tall, the pseudo marking target, if you like, in attack in case, you know, Kennedy or Darling aren't available to be a target and Oscar Allen sitting on the bench getting ready for a run in the ruck, to me, Jake Waterman is their best equipped player to play that role.
Yeah, there's some good flexibility in the team. The other benefit of having Oscar Allen is he can go back when needed if anything happens to one of the defenders early in a game as well. So there's a few that can move around.
All right. If you're West Coast, how do you get the Tim Kelly deal done, given that the mail we're getting is that West Coast is still the front runner for Tim Kelly services in 2020?
They say you have to give something good to get something good, but it's hard to let something good go. I just mentioned Oscar Allen. I just wonder whether Jared Brander has to be discussed again. The Eagles have clearly fallen in love with Oscar Allen, and clearly the long-term plan for the next 10 years is that he becomes one of the takes one of the main key forward posts after Kennedy's retirement, and Darling and Allen is the combo. So he's clearly more advanced than what Brander is. If Geelong are adamant that he needs to be part of the deal, it's going to be hard to say no to, I would have thought.
And is Geelong's Geelong, obviously, their position is weaker because Tim Kelly's coming out of contract. But if West Coast is Tim Kelly's preferred club, clearly Geelong is in a position where they can trade. Is Tim Kelly's price as high as it was last year, do you think? Can Geelong ask for two first-round picks or the equivalent of for Tim Kelly?
It probably ends up about being similar. His value is higher in the sense he's become an even better player in his second season than his first, but without the contract leverage there, without having another year, that probably brings it back down. So it's probably a similar type argument, I would have thought, to what we had last season.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I think you're absolutely right with Jared Brander. I think with a few of these young blokes, and I'd even put Jake Waterman in that bracket, I think West Coast is facing a use them or lose them sort of scenario, because eventually Jared Brander is a very talented young player. He hasn't really done anything wrong, and yet he's had very little opportunity in his first 2 years. So I would have thought that he's going to be one that's looking around. If Jake Waterman were to tumble out of the team again come finals time, I would think he would be looking around despite his family links to the club. So I think a Jared Brander and a first-round draft pick would probably be what Geelong would be looking for out of West Coast to get that Kelly deal done.
There's always future picks as well, so no doubt there's a way that West Coast will, you know, put an offer together without losing any players if they want to hold on to Brander. So maybe a first rounder and something in the future could get it done as well.
And of course, if Tim Kelly is prepared to go to Fremantle, and the indication is that he would be, but it's not his preferred choice, then that brings the Bradley Hill trade back into focus, doesn't it? Because if it took trading Bradley Hill, not necessarily to Geelong, but to someone who may be able to on-trade to Geelong to get Tim Kelly to Fremantle, then Fremantle will be very tempted to do that deal.
It's going to sort of satisfy the punters a bit as well, isn't it? I think if you can say to your fans, we're losing Bradley Hill, but it's helped us get Tim Kelly, I think you can sell that message.
So, okay, so you're the list manager at Fremantle, and that's fine. We understand that perception is very important, so keeping the punters happy is important. But if you're the list manager, are you happy for that to be used to get Tim Kelly, or would you rather see a draft pick that might bring, you know, a 250 game, top three best and fairest All Australian player to the club eventually?
I would have thought you should be holding on to your top 10 draft picks. I agreed with something you touched on before. I think too often clubs go after players when they've had a good year and offload players when they've had a bad year. I mean, it's like buying and selling shares, isn't it? If you're going to lose a player, the time to do it is after they've had a career best year. There's no guarantee he could get injured next year, a Bradley Hill, anything could happen. The time to sell a player, if you're going to do it, is when their value is at its highest. And I don't think Bradley Hill's value as a player will ever be higher in his career than what it will be this October. So that's probably something that they should cash in on if they can.
One more housekeeping matter before we move on to tipping for this weekend. Alex Rance has declared he won't be making a run to try and get back into Richmond's team for the finals. Common sense?
Yes, and I thought it was interesting that he did a sort of a club video. I think the club had, it looks like the club had enough of these miraculous comeback stories and just needed to focus on what they've got rather than what they haven't got. And they've asked him to do a video where he's announced, I'm not coming back, just to sort of kill off all the hope and speculation, which I know he'd been driving and hanging on to. So, yeah, that's put that to bed, and I think it's the right decision. If he ends up missing a flag, he's already won one a couple of years ago,
yep,
and he can start again next season, helping them go back to back.
And they're still young enough to do that too, aren't they, Richmond? So you'd expect Richmond to be in the frame again next year, regardless of what happens this year.
I wonder if they hadn't won that flag 2 years ago, if it would be harder to say no to him now, as he's approaching 30, trying to win a drought-breaking premiership. Maybe it would be a slightly different sort of decision and discussion if it's, especially if maybe they could structure, you know, his sort of future contract to take that risk into account if it was a risk he wanted to take. But he's won a flag and he can start round one next season. Hopefully, he is a strong fit player.
All right, moving on to tips for this week. Big game tomorrow night in Canberra, GWS versus Hawthorn. Of course, the Hawks tipped the Giants on their backside at the MCG earlier this year. I get the feeling there might be some revenge in the air for this one, Braden.
Yeah, I think GWS, but wasn't it interesting, the Sydney Derby last week? I actually sort of spent a little bit of time thinking about this, but in Canberra, about 0 degrees, I think they're talking about.
Woohoo!
As well. So that's going to be interesting, but GWS for me.
Are the Giants a flag threat for you, or do you think they're a little bit off that at the moment?
It's certainly different to a Perth team finishing fifth or sixth. It's not the longest flight. So if they get one home final, I think it's certainly more possible than what it would be if West Coast were to finish fifth or sixth. And I mean, the Giants could still finish in the four. So probably, I mean, if they finish fourth and had a win week one, if they go pretty close to becoming the flag favourite. So I still think everything's still possible for them.
Where have you got Hawthorn in your reckoning? Is Hawthorn cooked as a final threat, or are they still in the mix, you think?
No, I think they're gone. They're only on 8 wins, so Hawthorn are a game behind Fremantle, aren't they?
Yeah. And we think Fremantle's probably going to have to win in to make it.
So. Yeah, no, I don't see a way Hawthorn can get there.
All right, so it'll be interesting to see what Hawthorn do. If you're Hawthorn, Braden, and there's been a lot of talk that Coniglio obviously hasn't signed with GWS yet, are you going after a Stephen Coniglio and eating right into your salary cap and trying to load up that midfield with Tom Mitchell, Jaeger O'Meara and Coniglio and get yourself back into the mix like that? Or are you thinking, you know what, it's gone too far now, we need to go back to the draft?
Well, I know what Clarko's thinking, and he's thinking the former.
They don't believe in
the draft. I know at a recent Hawthorn game I covered at a post-match presser, Clarkson was talking about teams have won flags from where we are now the year before. He's looking at a flag next season. When you've won them, they're in your blood, and that's the sort of belief you get. No, I don't see him conceding that they need to go back and stock up with kids or do any sort of rebuild. He'll put the best possible list he can together to have a crack at next season.
Is that wisdom or hubris, do you think? Probably a bit of both.
Yeah, I don't have a huge problem with it, to be honest. We're in a salary cap competition. Everyone's got the same amount of money. Everyone starts on zero, and I'm happy with everyone starting out to win it. Could there be a price to pay further down the track? Possibly. Could they win the flag next year if they added a couple of quality players? Mitchell comes back well, and they get some improvement from some of their kids? Yes, why not?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I tend to think it's probably gone 1 year too many for Hawthorn now. He's talking about Sean Berger and going on again to next year. They're looking to offload Jared Roughhead. I think Grant Birchall will do very well to stay on their list at the end of the season. You start to eat fairly significantly into your depth. Isaac Smith's another one who looks like he, they were going to offer him up to trade a couple of weeks ago. Now it looks like he's had a bit of a renaissance at Hawthorn, but there's enough players there that aren't going to be any better to me to say that even with Coniglio and Mitchell, And there's no guarantee that Mitchell gets back going absolutely flat knacker after a broken leg either.
What happens in the next 5 years with Hawthorn will be really interesting, I think, because some of their list management stuff has been really, really different to what anyone else is doing. They tip blokes out early and either finish their careers or they move to another club to free up cap space, and then they try and bring in younger stars, and the draft doesn't play a part in it. Although they have found a good young key forward very, very late in the draft in Mitch Lewis, it seems like.
Yeah, he's a good player.
So it's amazing. They don't take many throws at the dartboard, but with one they've taken, they've landed one very late there.
So they're either ahead of everyone else's thinking in list management, or maybe the successes over the last decade have convinced them they're usually right when maybe this time they're wrong. It's going to be an interesting one to watch that play out over the coming years.
Well, on average, you'd say par is winning one flag every 18 years with 18 teams. So I'm happy to back them in to do things their way.
Yeah, I think, though, if they're honest, those flags came out of monumental drafting over a 2 or 3 year period. You know, the Franklin, Roughhead, Jordan Lewis, Sam Mitchell and Luke Hodge before that. I think that's where the nucleus of their premiership teams came out of. So I think if they're really honest with themselves, even if Clarko reckons it doesn't suit him to go back to the draft now, it was the draft that gave them the four flags, I would think.
There's no doubt about that. Maybe when you've been at the top, you don't want to be down at the other end for several years.
They have grown accustomed, perhaps. All right, let's move along. Melbourne versus Collingwood on Saturday. Melbourne, incredibly disappointing team this year. And the Pies, well, they did what they had to do against Gold Coast last week, didn't they? But they probably need something better against a better opponent to convince many of us they're going to be a factor in September.
Yeah, I've picked Collingwood. I don't rule out an upset here, though, but certainly it's one Collingwood need to win to keep the top four hopes alive.
Yeah, I'm going for the Pies. I think this will be close. I'm expecting something under 20 points. I just think Collingwood will go a little bit longer and harder than Melbourne, because Melbourne, really, what have they got to play for? And in fact, probably now, they're in that uncomfortable situation the AFL drafting creates every year, where the worse you go, the better it is for you, aren't they, Melbourne?
Yeah, there's not a lot to be gained. I mean, they need to get players right. They need to have a good pre-season and have a fit squad up and running for next year.
So do you put Melbourne's failure down this year all to that, or do you think there's more to it than that?
Oh, it has to be a combination of reasons, I think, for everything we see in footy. It's interesting, you know, some of the more disillusioned Melbourne fans are saying that this year isn't the odd one out. Last year was. This year they've just come back, as Ross Lyon would say, regressed to the mean. They've just come back to what they always have been. So, I mean, next year is going to tell us a huge story, isn't it, with Melbourne? But, you know, there were obviously extremely high hopes coming into this season after a prelim last year.
He's got these great sayings, Ross, hasn't he? I don't know where he gets them from and where his source for all his quotes and his great analogies is, but he certainly keeps us amused and stimulated at his press conference. He usually comes out with something every week that gets our amusement.
I think the fascinating thing about Melbourne for me were the reports earlier this season that the head of fitness went to the board before a ball had been bounced in round one
and basically
and
told
said
them.
We're in trouble because we haven't got enough sessions into enough players. That's really fascinating, that kind of study to me. And if that sort of analysis holds up across the competition, doesn't that just place so much importance on sort of the 6 months where we're not competing, where we're watching cricket and enjoying Christmas beers and everything else? Isn't it important to have a good pre-season?
Well, I'll invoke another Ross Lyon saying here. He says premierships aren't won between April and September. They're won between November and April. And Hawthorn actually supports this scenario. Hawthorn did data on this, and they did a successful season and what they would have considered an unsuccessful season. And they found that in their unsuccessful season, a critical mass of players had not completed a certain number of training sessions over summer. And the result of that was the inevitable flow-on of too many players out of form, too many players performing at something less than their capability, and basically what they would have considered a failed season.
Having said that, I don't think West Coast had the smoothest of summers with injury-wise, and some stars having surgeries and being put out from time to time, and they were 3-3, but they managed to get through that and build. So it's something you can fight through as well, no doubt.
Absolutely, and I think having better players helps. Port Adelaide versus Sydney. This game is going to have a big bearing on the makeup of the top eight, obviously, with Port Adelaide just out of eighth spot at the moment and pressing to get in at Adelaide Oval. How are you seeing this one, Braden? I'm thinking the Power gets this done because they have to.
Yeah, I mean, it's all hell will break loose in Adelaide if Port loses this after winning away. If they then go home and drop this when they've got a chance to take the spot of their crosstown rival in the eight. If they drop to Sydney, who are 15th, there'll be all sorts of hell to pay there. And I wouldn't really want to be Ken Hinckley. So this is a huge game. I know there's a lot of talk about Port win one, lose one, but surely they win this one.
So is this comfortable or is this going to be close, do you think?
I think it'll be uncomfortable at times, but I'll get there by a few goals.
Yeah, I think they'll be pushing towards 30 points in this one, and certainly necessity being the mother of invention, I think Port gets this one at home. I think this one definitely will be comfortable. It's the Queensland Q clash, Brisbane Lions versus the Suns. It's at the Gabba, and I think we'll be calling the Gabba the Gabbatoir after this one.
Yeah, it's hard to know whether Gold Coast's improved effort against Essendon sort of said more about Essendon dropping off or them picking up, because they'd fallen right away a few weeks ago. It's hard to see there being anything less than a 10-goal margin here, though, I would have thought.
Where have you got Brisbane come the end of the home and away season? They'll be in most people's top four. Can you see them snaring a top two spot in a home qualifying final?
If Geelong falls over, yes. I think a lot depends on Geelong. I think we sort of penciled in, well, I did, some wins for Geelong coming home. But if you drop to Fremantle, I'm not sure there's not one or two more that Geelong might not drop. So if Geelong are going to sort of fall like a rock to the bottom of the river, well, Brisbane can float up, yeah.
And one of Geelong's games in the coming weeks is they've got to go to Brisbane and play the Lions at the Gabba. So you're right. I think Geelong is the team in the top two that's in peril at the moment, even though the ladder says they're still on top of the ladder by virtue of their strong percentage.
This is just one of the things in West Coast's favour, is that some of these other top four candidates are playing each other in the last couple of weeks. That could end up being very important. We know Adam Simpson sort of talked down the percentage issue, which Craig O'Donoghue's been very hot on, losing 1% in the final 2 minutes of the game. But that could be really important, the fact that there's a couple of matchups where we know there has to be one loser in the last couple of weeks.
And, of course, West Coast is involved in one of them as well. They play Richmond at the MCG before.
And there's your classic eight-point game, which John Worsfold told us didn't exist. So there it is.
Essendon versus the Western Bulldogs. It's at Marvel Stadium. I'm going to go for the Doggies here, Braden. I just get the feeling that the Bombers are a little bit shaky. They're a little bit shaky manpower-wise at the moment too. A few injuries creeping into their team late in the season.
Well, I've done the same thing. I'm not sure if we're both going the upset. I haven't seen the betting market. I assume this would be the upset. Yeah, Essendon obviously.
Essendon marginal favourite. So it's about $1.90 to $1.94.
Essendon scrambled terrifically well. There's some interesting stats over Essendon's winning patch that actually shows they didn't dominate at all. And I think they were behind in nearly all of the last quarters. So it obviously says a lot about sort of guts and going to the end to get those wins. But they maybe have masked exactly where Essendon are at. And up and about at Marvel, the Dogs can play some pretty good games.
I've asked this question of the other quarters a few times. Are you disappointed in the Western Bulldogs? I keep looking at that midfield, and I think that is pretty much their premiership midfield. Why aren't they definitely playing finals?
I guess the issues with their tools, but yeah, isn't it interesting? I mean, I've seen some people talk about why isn't Luke Beveridge under the pressure Ross Lyon's been under.
Mm.
Well, it's all about premierships, isn't it? And you win a premiership, and he's bought himself a few years' grace, I think. I think that's what it comes down to. And now a contract extension.
Yes, very true. All right. Now, this one, I'm going to be very interested to get your thoughts on this one. Geelong versus North Melbourne. It is at Cadinia Park, or GMHBA Stadium, as it's now known. First versus 13th. But if you look at the form lines of the two teams, this is anything but a gimme for the Cats.
Yes, agree with all of that. I've picked Geelong. It's just hard to tip against them down there. But, I mean, if last week was warning bells for Geelong, I mean, if they drop one to North, a team 13th on the table at their sort of fortress, they're in lots of trouble, though. I think they'll get it done.
Yeah, I'm tipping Geelong. I suspect that The alarm bells would really have rung in the wake of the loss to Fremantle last week. And that's not to pour cold water on what Fremantle did, but I don't think any of us saw a 34-point win to Fremantle coming in that game. And that if the Cats needed a wake-up call, I think that is the wake-up call. And I think we'll see a leaner and hungrier Geelong team this week. And we may see some structural change as a result of what happened at Optus Stadium last week.
If Geelong did go down, doesn't that just blow open the top of the table and suddenly everyone's eyeing off top spot, including Richmond?
Well, and I think the other thing is that with Geelong still having to go to Brisbane, I mean, do we go to a point from a point where we were thinking Geelong, we just assumed they'd finish top two, to where if things go right for Collingwood and or Richmond and or GWS and things go badly for Geelong from here on into the end of the season, could Geelong miss a top four spot and be facing a do or die final, first week of the finals?
Just something else I was thinking about earlier this week. Under the farcical MCG contract rule we used to have to endure in the 90s, if Geelong was to sort of fall and Brisbane was to finish top, West Coast second, and then some Victorian teams like Collingwood and Essendon fifth and sixth, West Coast would have to, and say Richmond finished fourth, West Coast would have finished second and had to host Richmond at the MCG for finishing second. What an absolute farce.
And they would have been told by Victorians that there was no home ground disadvantage by playing at the MCG.
So isn't it? I mean, we take it for granted now, but it wasn't that long ago, as you no doubt remember. So at least for clubs like West Coast, Brisbane, GWS fighting for home finals, you know you're actually going to get the finals you've earned.
Absolutely.
Besides the grand final.
Sunday, August 11 at Marvel Stadium. This game will also will hold a lot of local interest, and it'll also have a big determination on the top eight. Fremantle within striking distance of the eight now after their great win last week. They're 11th. They're playing the 14th ranked Saints, but obviously it's St Kilda's home game, St Kilda's home ground, and also the scene of probably Fremantle's most disappointing effort of the year against the Western Bulldogs just 2 weeks ago. The Saints or the Dockers, Braden?
Yeah, obviously Fremantle were amazing last week. It was just great fun. I think we all had great fun covering that game. Going along to something where you get an outcome you certainly don't expect and aren't prepared for is a lot of fun. So I just can't get Fremantle's last visit to this same ground out of my mind, though, and on that basis I've picked St Kilda.
I'm picking St Kilda, but I don't think we can expect Fremantle to be like they were the last time. I know that Ross discounted this after the game, but I think the decision to go with three big men into that game against the Western Bulldogs was a really bad error of selection. I think it worked for him the previous week against Sydney, who don't spread a lot and are more a grind team like the Dockers are. I thought when they picked all of Lobb, Darcy and Sanderlands, they left themselves vulnerable on the spread, and that's exactly what happened. They got outspread and they got absolutely cooked by a gun midfield. I don't think they'll do that again. I think, if anything, they'll err the other way. I think they'll go a bit smaller, and that may hurt them a little bit, but I think they'll put a lot better pressure on around the ball and they'll compete a lot harder. That said, I think Fremantle's away record this year suggests that despite great wins against GWS and Collingwood, I think their wins on the road have been pretty hard to come by. And I think St Kilda are playing reasonably solidly under Brett Ratton, and I think they may mark this one down as one more they can get before the end of the season.
I really hope we see Hugh Dixon make a debut as well. Ross mentioned him. I just think, how could you not play the only fit key forward on your list? Surely you need one of them. I know they got away last week with arresting Ruckman and David Mundy, but he's fit. He's coming towards the end of his second year now, and all your other key forwards have fallen over. So give him a shot.
So who comes out?
That's a good question, but it has to be one of the smalls that played forward last week, I suppose. I know they did well.
Are you getting dangerously close to that situation that they were in when they played the Doggies, where you have the three lumbering big men, and if they don't mark the ball, then you get exposed with run?
Well, I wouldn't have a huge problem if Aaron Sandilands rested at home for a big home game next week.
If he didn't go,
I just think I like the idea of a natural key forward. Mm. If you've got five or six on your list, the rest of them are injured, well, let the kid who's fit have a go.
I'd love to see Dixon play. I'd also love to see Sam Sturt play. I'd also love to see Tom North play, but I noticed he didn't run around in the waffle last week, so clearly he's a little way away.
Picked up an injury, I think.
Yeah. All right, so both St Kilda?
St Kilda.
All right. 4th versus 16th on Sunday at the MCG, Richmond versus Carlton. Carlton were okay against West Coast last week, weren't they? Do you give them any chance against the Tigers?
Yeah, I thought they were up and about in the first half, and so was their crowd with the perception that the umpiring was running against them. I thought really enjoyed that first half last week with Carlton giving as good as they got. Yeah, I've got Richmond here, but should be a decent game.
Absolutely. I think Richmond and West Coast, in most people's eyes, are the two form teams of the competition. Interesting, Braden, Marlon Pickett made his VFL debut for Richmond last weekend. Was very impressive, apparently. Be interesting to see, A, where he sits in their selection this week, and also, assuming that he doesn't quite make it into the 22, if he could somehow put another strong effort together, whether Damien Hardwick's going to be prepared to give him a look before the end of the home and away season.
I find all that strange. He's been completely fit and overlooked in drafts and then taken in a mid-season draft while he's injured. I find it very strange. Anyway, they've clearly seen something in him, and hopefully he becomes a great player for them. But isn't it strange? We see Tim Kelly getting missed, just some odd recruiting type decisions with some...
Yeah, I think there's too much. I think too much of our recruiting in particular from our two clubs here, perhaps not so much West Coast. I think it's too much Melbourne-based. And I think they don't look hard enough in their own backyard. And I think that's been clearly evidenced in some drafts. I think the Waffle is a very good competition, and I think it produces very good players.
Well, I know there's been clubs calling Anthony Vanderweel and Tim Kelly's manager saying, where is the next one? Who else is over there? And he says, I've been giving you names for the last 5 years and you've been ignoring them.
Well, and so, of that great trio out of South Fremantle, of course, there was Tim Kelly. There was Marley and Pickett, and there's still Hayden Sloyth running around in the Waffle. So there you go. Moving on to the last game of the round, West Coast versus Adelaide, Optus Stadium on Sunday. Braden, I still think the Crows are in trouble. There seems to be this little bit of a buzz behind the scenes at Adelaide that there's a few off-field issues going on, that there may have been some angst between Josh Jenkins and Don Pike when Pike dropped him last week. Do you give the Crows any chance in this game, or do you think this is a comfortable West Coast victory?
It needs to be comfortable because West Coast needs some percentage. Don Pike had a very interesting press conference in Adelaide this morning, which I saw, and of course all these issues were simmering, and he's quite annoyed, and he's actually said, how do you think I would go in a fight against Josh Jenkins? I weigh 80 kilos and he's probably twice his age. And but he was actually very, very angry, Don Pike. He called for more accountability from the media. He says there's, erroneous rumour and speculation which is being run as fact, and so there's certainly plenty of issues bubbling there. They're going to come over here and have a run at the Wacker on Saturday. Of course, Optus is out because of the rugby on Saturday night. Jenkins is going to miss again. They're going to leave him at home to play Sandful. Yeah, they need a win. Adelaide, I'm not sure they're going to get it over here against the Eagles.
Is their problem really about their tall forwards? I mean, we've potted Josh Jenkins a couple of times this year, and we've also potted Taylor Walker a couple of times this year. Not so much in recent weeks. I actually think they've both been okay in recent weeks. So I was a bit surprised to see Josh come out of the team again. To me, they just lack pace midfield, and that means they're a bit like West Coast in 2017, where they are continually getting exposed by other teams on the spread, and their team always looks better on paper than it really is in practice.
And just to follow up the Jenkins issue, which has been a big one in Adelaide, it's easy to forget now. He was a hugely in-demand player a couple of years ago, yeah. And they re-signed him to a big, long, expensive deal after he'd had a good year. And now if they have to handball him out this year because he wants some opportunity somewhere else, they're not going to get a huge amount for him because he's been running around in the sandfall.
Yeah, that's right. He's going to be it's a classic case of your argument about Brad Hill, sell at the top of the market, not at the bottom of the market.
Well, they've bought and invested in Jenkins when his value was sky high, and yeah, now it's pretty hard to get a lot for players when you're playing them in the sandfall.
So we're both tipping West Coast to win this game. You've mentioned percentage being important to them. What's your margin, do you think, in this game for West Coast?
Look, if you offer Adam Simpson a 1-point win right now, he probably takes it. As he says, we keep winning, we'll be okay. And given the fixtures with the other sides playing each other, I think he's probably right. But I mean, they'd love a 6-8 goal win, I would have thought.
Just to give them that little bit of insurance, that little bit of a buffer.
Touch. Well, it's all so tight. Yeah, less than one percentage point ahead of Brisbane in third at the moment, and just think what Brisbane could possibly pick up against Gold Coast. That could be potentially a little bit scary. I mean, they could get enough percentage there that West Coast don't catch them. So, yeah, every goal is going to be important for West Coast, and more importantly, if you understand how percentage works, every goal you can stop the opposition from scoring is what really matters.
Okay, so now that we've told people who we think is going to win, how's your tipping been going generally? Sum it up in a word.
Shite.
Is that a word? It's probably a better word than the proper word, I would think. All right, well, yeah, I'm just, I'm going okay, but it always could be better. Thank you very much for joining us today. We've been brought to you by Tab Touch. We'll be back. There'll be a Quartermain. Not necessarily Braden, in the studio with me on Tuesday, where we'll dissect the round and talk about the ramifications with two rounds remaining. Hopefully, we've got Fremantle on 10 wins looking to win again and maybe even play finals. And hopefully, we've got West Coast challenging for that top two berth that will give them their best chance at a flag. It's been great talking to you today, and we'll talk to you again on Tuesday.
This has been the Duff and Quarters podcast, brought to you by Tab Touch.